Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. Today marks the beginning of a new fiscal year in Florida government with a nearly $91 billion budget. Today also marks the day when a number of new laws take effect that were passed by elected officials during this year's annual legislative session. The new laws cover a broad spectrum of topics that will impact K-12 students and their families, motorists, patients, immigrants, and Florida's agriculture community. One of those laws makes Florida one of the last states in the nation to make texting while driving a primary offense. A bit later in this conversation, Florida Highway Patrol Lieutenant Greg Bueno with the department's Public Affairs Division will join us to explain what that law will mean for drivers statewide. But first, WGCU's legislative analyst John Davis joins me in studio for a breakdown of some of the other laws taking effect today. Thanks for joining us, John.
Of course. Thanks.
And if you'd like to add your voice to our conversation, call us now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Or you can ask a question via social media. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, John, one of the new laws taking effect today will impact K-12 students and their families. It's an expansion of Florida's private school voucher program. Can you give us details?
Yeah, this is considered an historic expansion of school choice here in Florida, which, of course, Governor DeSantis has been a vocal supporter of. It does a couple of things. One, it addresses a backlog of students seeking to attend a private or religious school through the Florida Tax Credit Scholarship Program. That's funded through contributions.
And that was something already in place.
Yes.
Gotcha.
It also creates a new program to provide private school access to more students with a $130 million investment of taxpayer funds. And this new program is called the Family Empowerment Scholarship.
Gotcha. And this is something that got started all the way back under Jeb Bush, right?
Correct.
And this has been a long arc toward this. Mm-hmm. So how many students would potentially gain a private school voucher through this expansion of the program? And how is eligibility determined?
Well, under the Florida Tax Credit Scholarship Program, you're looking at a current wait list, a backlog of 13,000 students. So it's looking to address that right away. And again, that's funded through those corporate tax revenue diverted from the general revenue fund. But as far as the new Family Empowerment Scholarship Program, they're looking to enroll 18,000 students in a private or religious school through a voucher. And then they're looking to add about 7,000 students each year in future years. Eligibility is going to be determined based on family income. So they're looking at families earning 300% of federal poverty guidelines. What that looks like would be a family of four making at most $77,000 a year. So these are families who've maybe wanted to send their kid to a private school through a voucher program in the past, but under previous eligibility guidelines, they've earned too much money to qualify.
So Governor DeSantis has been a vocal supporter of school choice, and naturally school choice advocates are praising this move, but not everybody's happy about it. Who are the opposition and why?
I think the loudest voice of opposition we've been hearing throughout the legislative session has been the Florida Education Association. That's the statewide teachers union. They put out a report a couple months ago anticipating the impact of this move is going to be a net loss of more than $986 million for public schools in Florida across the state over the next 5 years. So to break that down, the FEA is predicting that this legislation will cost the Collier County School District more than $4.5 million by the end of the 2022-23 school year. In Lee County, that adds up to $12 million loss. And in Sarasota, it's going to be a more than a $6 million loss. They're generally saying they think that this is misguided. They point to test data from the Florida Department of Education indicating that the performance of students who have attended private schools through vouchers tend to lag behind their peers who stayed in public schools. On the other hand, Governor Ron DeSantis has cited a recent Urban Institute study showing that low-income, mostly minority students using the Florida Tax Credit Scholarship Program are 43% more likely to enroll in a four-year college than students in public schools and up to 20% more likely to actually earn a bachelor's degree. So I think at the end of the day, folks can find data that supports what they think about it. But I think the general arguments come down to if you have students in a chronically poor-performing public school, does it make more sense to give more money to private school options for them, or does it make more sense to more properly invest in those failing public schools to get their students performing better?
So another new law taking effect today is the so-called Sanctuary Cities Ban. It requires local governments to honor detainer requests from Immigration and Customs Enforcement for suspected unauthorized immigrants already in the custody of local law enforcement agencies who've been arrested or convicted of another crime. So break down what this new new law means for local municipalities here in Florida.
Okay. So this is definitely one of Governor DeSantis's campaign promises being met. He was very vocal about this on the campaign trail. And it's kind of preemptive in the sense that Florida doesn't actually have any sanctuary cities. And in addition to requiring law enforcement to honor detainer requests, it's also going to give power to the state attorney general, Ashley Moody, to actually sue municipalities to force them into compliance. And that specific aspect of the bill isn't going to go into effect until October 1st. For local municipalities, I don't see this having much of an effect at all. By that, I would cite the Collier County Sheriff's Office, which has voluntarily been a member of the 287G program under the Federal Immigration and Nationality Act for years now. So I don't think for many municipalities here in Florida it's going to make much of a difference. Local law enforcement agencies are already, for the most part, complying with ICE detainer requests.
Gotcha. Supporters of this law point to data like the Pew Research Center's finding that Florida has the third largest population of unauthorized immigrants in the country, with about 825,000 people. What do critics of the new law have to say about it?
So critics of the law charge that it's politically motivated. They fear it's going to increase anti-immigrant sentiment, and they point to this narrative of unauthorized immigrants being criminals. And that kind of counters what we see in a lot of federal prison data that shows unauthorized immigrants per capita are actually far less likely to be committing crimes than U.S. citizens per capita. But groups like the American Civil Liberties Union argue that the bill would have unintended consequences like splitting up immigrant families, hurting minority communities. And I think probably one of the most cogent concerns from groups like the ACLU is what happens when a local law enforcement agency complies with an ICE detainer request, and then it turns out that the person being targeted was actually a U.S. citizen all along. And that happens. This is not a hypothetical situation. The ACLU finds that between February of 2017 and February of this year, ICE issued detainers for 420 people in Miami-Dade County that, according to jail records, were U.S. citizens. At least 83 of those detainer requests were later rescinded. When this happens, you have a U.S. citizen who has been unlawfully detained, and they can sue, charging a violation of their Fourth Amendment right to be secure against unreasonable searches and seizures. And when that happens, the local law enforcement agency is the one left holding the bag, not the federal agency that actually made the detainer request.
So also beginning today, there's a new ban on vaping indoors. So what's that all about?
So this stems from the Constitutional Amendment 9 that voters passed last November. That was one of those weird ballot initiatives put on there by the Constitution Revision Commission. It also included banning offshore drilling in state waters, completely unrelatedly. But it bans vaping in indoor workspaces. So this is an expansion of the Florida Clean Indoor Air Act that was originally passed back in the mid-80s, and that was about addressing the concerns of secondhand smoke. Now, the law does not prohibit vaping inside private residences or in retail tobacco shops, standalone bars, or even in hotel rooms where smoking is allowed. But supporters just point to the fact that we really don't have any data on the long-term effects of vaping or exposure to secondhand vape, just because it hasn't been around long enough for us to have that data.
Okay, so there are two other new state laws that take effect today, but they'll require approval from the federal government before they truly take effect. One pertains to the development of a hemp industry in the state. What's that all about?
Well, this is one I know we've covered in past editions of Gulf Coast Live. This was advocated for heavily by Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried, and it really just charges her department with creating an initial regulatory framework for the development of a hemp industry in the state, which she wants Florida to become a leader in, particularly given losses our agriculture community throughout the state has dealt with. Think about the timber industry from the impacts of Hurricane Michael last year. Of course, citrus growers, and this could give them something else to grow. The federal farm bill passed last year was really what opened the door to allowing states to create these. But this could really be a robust industry in Florida. It's such a versatile product. This can be used in everything from, you know, textiles and clothing to building materials, hempcrete. You can build houses out of this.
Mm-hmm. And we've talked about all that on this show.
Yes.
The other law that's going into effect that'll still require federal approval aims to create cheaper access to prescription medicines. What's that?
So this is intended to give Floridians access to cheaper prescription drugs from Canada and perhaps even from other unspecified foreign countries. It actually creates two separate programs. One would allow residents to get drugs through, you know, their conventional retail pharmacies, and the other one gives the state access to cheaper drugs for patients, say, in the prison system or who are getting assistance through Medicaid program. And it's just a really big concern because we know that in the U.S., drug prices, compared to what folks pay in other countries, it's just really a huge disparity there. U.S. prices for the world's top 20 selling medications on average are 3 times higher in the U.S. than they are in, say, Great Britain. And that's according to an analysis carried out by Reuters. And it's really just because the U.S. leaves pricing to market competition, whereas other countries, their healthcare systems don't do that. This was lobbied against heavily by Big Pharma. That, of course, makes sense. Financially speaking, they have the most to lose from a program like this. But even with this law taking effect today, it's still going to need approval from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And even once it gets that thumbs up, it goes back to the legislature for another round of considerations. So don't expect anything from this to be taking effect anytime soon, just because the law technically takes effect today.
Okay. And now we're going to pivot now to a to focus in on the new texting while driving ban that goes into law today. Although drivers will only be receiving warnings if pulled over for now, the actual fines will begin on January 1st of next year. We're joined now to break down just what this new ban includes by Greg Bueno. He's a lieutenant in the Public Affairs Division of the Florida Highway Patrol. Lieutenant Bueno, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And real quick, for starters, how is the trooper doing who was struck by a tow truck on Alligator Alley this morning?
He is doing well, and we're counting our blessings. Of course, it's a serious incident that could have been much more serious. He was transported to a local hospital, but has since been released, and we're very thankful for that.
Okay, so let's turn to texting while driving. Now, this really encompasses more than just texting, correct?
It does. Well, at the end of the day, what we're talking about is distraction. This specific law is basically turning what's always been against the law, which is texting, from a secondary offense to a primary offense, meaning that law enforcement sees you on your phone, inputting information into your phone, email, text. We can stop you. It is probable cause, and we can charge you accordingly.
And this will include tablets, any kind of mobile device, basically, right?
Well, yeah, by law, it's what they define a wireless communication as is anything used in a handheld manner, designated or intended to receive, transmit, text, access stored data, access the Internet, those type of things. So it could be a tablet, it could be a phone, yes.
And talking on the phone with your phone, just talking on it, that's still legal in Florida, correct?
It's still legal. Now, there's a caveat to that. Coming October 1st, the wireless communication devices can only be used in a hands-free manner when driving in a designated school crossing, school zone, or work zone area. So basically it's hands-free. If you're in a school zone or work zone, that is going to be an additional restriction placed on all drivers in the state of Florida come October 1st.
Are troopers and other law enforcement officers given any sort of training on to how to determine whether, you know, it seems like sort of a hard thing to tell that somebody from a distance is using their phone in an improper way?
Well, it is. And we are, to answer your question, we are giving training. But beyond that, you know, this has been against the law, the text and drive. It's just not been a primary offense. And we have issued citations for it in the past. However, now that it's a primary offense, it's going to be something that I think as anyone driving down the road, if you are all aware of your circumstances, you look left, you look right, you're going to see people on the phone. And whether they're texting or emailing or what have you, it's certainly probable cause for us to pull them over, and we can take the traffic stop from that point.
You know, we're here at Florida Gulf Coast University, and I got to tell you, the number of selfies I see being taken while driving is really not encouraging. Once a driver is pulled over because a law enforcement officer sees them using a mobile device, is there any way for them to prove they were doing it? Are they able to look at their phone and say, I see you just sent a text, or some sort of other evidence from the device?
Well, they can volunteer information to us as law enforcement. They don't have to show us their phone or give us their phone or anything like that, but they can certainly volunteer some sort of information. There are exceptions to the law, for example, if you're on your navigation. But beyond what people can, you know, dissect things and get away with. Let's get to the moral of what this is all about, is being safe behind the wheel. And we know as law enforcement, to do that, you have to have two eyes on the road, two hands on the wheel, and your mind on driving, because there's been all too often times where we've had tragedies occur from people being distracted. For example, more than 52,000 crashes happened by distracted drivers in 2018, resulting in 233 fatalities and over 3,000 serious injuries. That's why we need to focus on driving.
Do you have any sense, and you might not have this data in front of you right now or in your brain, but do you have any sense of how much maybe that's scaled up since, like, the invention of the iPhone 12 years ago, that sort of thing?
I don't have it how much it's scaled up, but I can tell you, though, one thing I'd like to stress, distractions just aren't the phones. They are other passengers in the car. We see people watching TV. We see people reading newspapers, you know, multitasking, eating, drinking. These are all things that are taking the focus away from driving. You know, what we do know is the age of 20 to 24 is the highest violator in distracted driving crashes. And, you know, and if you break down that 52,000 number I gave you, on a statewide average, every week there's more than 1,000 distracted driving crashes. We certainly can do better.
You know, this is, I don't know if this is something you've given much thought to, but one of the most dangerous things about using a smartphone is having to look at the screen, because there's no real feedback. You have to look at the screen in order to type something into it. And the newer cars, like the Teslas, have interfaces on them that are completely touchscreen related. Do you see that as a possible sort of vector for distracted driving in and of itself?
Well, I think I'm going to stick to my what I said earlier. I think anything that takes those hands off the wheel, your eyes off the road, or your mind off of driving is dangerous. It's a potential distraction. And, you know, that's where we have to really reach deep into our own personal integrity, decide what's important here. What's important is to get your destination safely, not put others in danger. If you do need to interact via communication, you know, pull over where it's safe, where you can focus on that communication. And then you can drive and focus on driving when you're finished.
So starting today, drivers will get warnings, correct? And then January 1st is when the actual penalties will come into play?
Well, I can only speak for the Florida Highway Patrol. Now, as of today, it is against the law. Someone can be cited for this today.
Oh, okay.
Now, Florida Highway Patrol is issuing warnings up to through the end of the year. Again, every traffic stop that we make, whether it's pulling someone over for texting or what have you, it's an opportunity for us to educate people, too. It's not all about enforcement. We certainly want to educate the public. Now, in the event we see someone doing something egregious behind the wheel while using a phone, if they're involved in a crash that results in a serious injury or fatality, we will certainly hold them to the standards of this law.
Can you break down what the penalties are for first, second, and third, you know, conviction?
Yeah, sure. First offense is a non-moving traffic violation. There is a base $30 fine, but let me stress with that. The $30 fine is base. Like I said, each county, there's going to be additional fines that increase that quite substantially. So that would be on a difference on a county-by-county basis. It is non-moving. Now, if you get stopped for a second or subsequent violation within 5 years, that increases to $60. Again, not including court costs or other fees. And now you're also going to be issued 3 points into your driving record.
Gotcha. And then is there a third that scales up any higher, or is that it?
What the law is stating now, that secondary stop addresses second or subsequent offenses. Now,
gotcha.
I'm sure if someone appears before a judge after multiple violations, the judge will act accordingly. Now, one other thing. In regarding to the hands-free communication that starts in October 1st for school zones and work zones, that is a moving violation. Should someone be using their phone, fine of $60 base, not including court costs, and it carries a 3-point violation toward their license.
Gotcha. And real quick, last question. So if a driver is issued with a citation, this will be like any other violation. They'll either just pay it or they'll go and fight it in court.
Yeah, exactly. They don't have, by taking a citation, not an admission of guilt. It's simply agreeing to either pay the fine or contest the court.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for today's show. Thanks to my guest, Lieutenant Greg Bueno with the Florida Highway Patrol. Lieutenant Bueno, thank you for taking some time for us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thanks to our earlier guests, Dr. Leslie Norins, Naples resident and founder and president of the Alzheimer's Germ Quest, and Dr. Thomas Feketa, chair of the Infectious Diseases Society of America Foundation and chair of medicine at Temple University Hospital in Philadelphia. If you missed part of today's show, you can always hear episodes in their entirety on our website, gulfcoastlive.org, or you can subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Our show today was produced by John Davis and myself. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thank you for listening. I'm Mike Canary. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.